Hello, and welcome to My Cape York Life, real-life stories of the people who live on and care for Cape York Peninsula.
Oh, there was a white-breasted sea eagle just downstream that was looking for some breakfast, and there's a wampu pigeon calling across here. It's just absolutely paradise.
The brog was all lifted off when I drove in this morning. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, it was beautiful. Fishing, out all day, hanging out with families and friends and getting together for big feastings and celebrations and watching footy every night at Bamiga.
You know, you get people that were dropped off trawlers in Princess Charlotte Bay and then they just start walking and you just find them in the middle of nowhere walking along in their underpants or something. You do see some funny things in the bush.
Cape York is 137,000 square kilometres and home to just over 15,000 people. Picture this: savannah, World Heritage listed rainforest, bauxite plateaus, wetlands of national significance, beautiful beaches and rivers, and a diversity of flora and fauna. The Cape is an absolutely amazing place. It's on the bucket list for many Australians. It's remote, it's hot, and it's wet. But this challenging landscape is surprisingly fragile and needs lots of tender, loving care. You're about to meet the people who care for this beautiful place. If you live here, you've visited, or you're planning that great escape, My Cape York Life is for you. I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management, and it's my pleasure to show you around the Cape and share with you the stories of the remarkable people who live and work here. My Cape York Life is brought to you by Cape York Natural Resource Management, with support from South Cape York Catchments and the Australian Government's National Land Care Program. You can find it on our website or your favourite podcast app. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. In this, our first episode, we're on the banks of the beautiful Wenlock River in northwest Cape York at Steve Irwin Wildlife Reserve. It's named for the man who became internationally known as a crocodile hunter, but his real passion was crocodile conservation. Appropriately, the reserve is home to the world's most comprehensive crocodile research program. It's not long after sunrise, before it gets too hot, and there's a good breeze by the river. It's a great spot for a chat with Shelley Lyon, who has spent 40 adventurous years on the Cape with her husband Barry. And together, they look after this spectacular place.
Oh, Lyndall, it's just beautiful. We've got a rocky crossing, shallow area, and deep holes either side of that. The water's pretty clear, especially in the shallow areas. The tide has just come right up, and it fills the bottom area of the river, and then it completely fills the top, and the river starts running back in the opposite direction, which is a pretty amazing phenomena for Cape York or anywhere, really.
It's certainly an absolutely beautiful spot here. Shelley, you've lived on the Cape for almost 40 years now.
Yeah, that's right, Lyndall. First came up in 1978. Yeah, moved to the Cape permanently in 1979.
So you've always been a North Queensland girl?
Yeah, grew up in Townsville. My father actually moved to Townsville in 1961 to start James Cook University. He moved up from St Lucia in Brisbane, and my family lived there ever since. We were very lucky. My parents had bought a beach house where Bushland Beach is now, and so we had a fantastic childhood, you know, every school holidays, every weekend, just hanging out in the bush, because that's all there was there in those days. And yeah, very fortunate upbringing.
So what kinds of things were you doing as a kid at the beach at Bushland Beach near Townsville?
Oh, we had, you know, cars, motorbikes, fishing, playing on the beach. The tide used to go right out there. You know, so there was always something interesting. I had two older brothers and an older sister, and, you know, we always had friends and cousins, and there was an Indigenous family that had a camp there with a heap of kids, and so there was always someone your age to hang out with, and, yeah, we really did have a lot of fun as kids there.
You did your schooling in Townsville?
Yeah, I went to Mundingburra State School, which was at the time the biggest primary school in the state, and then Pimlico High School, which was the biggest high school in the state at the time. So I seemed to do okay there.
And you left school and you started working for the council?
Yeah, I worked for Townsville's City Council at the time in their engineering department as a tracer.
What's a tracer?
Yeah, like a draftswoman, and in the days before computers.
Mm.
Oh, I'm showing my age here, I'm sorry. All plans and things were done by hand. So, you know, where all the sewage lines went, where all, you know, site plans, where you wanted to build your house on your block and things like that. That's the sort of work that I did.
So why did you choose that career path?
Oh, at school I just really enjoyed what we called it tech drawing in those days. I think they call it geometrical drawing and perspective these days, but it's all, yeah, computerised. The sort of stuff I did just doesn't exist anymore, but I really enjoyed that work. So, I was lucky enough to find a job in that area and, yeah, loved my time there.
And were there many women working in that field at the time?
There was a few.
Yeah.
Most of the engineers and draftsmen were men, but there was I think there's about three of us traces in the department at the time.
Okay, so you're working for Townsville City Council?
Yes.
Townsville City Council. Back then. And you met this fella at some stage called Barry.
Yeah, it was a bit wild looking in those days. We probably both were. But Barry had actually grown up in Brisbane and he'd moved to Townsville to a job with National Parks in their research and planning branch. So he was working with Collimpus at the time, doing research with crocodiles and sea turtles and fauna survey stuff. And, we met one night at a square dance.
At a square dance.
Yeah, I think it's probably the one and only one we ever both attended, but it was fate and, we met and a few years later got married.
How old were you when you got married?
I was 18 when we got married.
18 when you got married.
Mm-hmm.
And the adventure began.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you were living in Townsville still at the time and then Barry's working for Parks and he got posted.
Yeah, he worked away an incredible amount of time. So, you know, he'd be away for months at a time, you know, at Monrepo tagging turtles or, you know, up in the Gulf doing crocodile work. We decided, seeing we were getting married, that he might like to hang around a little bit more. And so they offered for us to go across to the National Park management side of National Parks. And at the time, they were in the process of acquiring Lakefield National Park and asked, would we be interested in going up there? So we said yes.
As you would. As people do. Mm. So Lakefield was just about to be, or had just been acquired.
Yeah, they were in the process of buying it and figuring out what they were going to do with it, I guess, you know, with the view of it becoming a national park. And we did a trip up through the Cape with the fellow Jim Wilkinson, who was the regional manager of National Parks in the north at the time. And yeah, when we were going through Lakefield, he kind of casually mentioned one night around the camp, how would you like to live here? And Barry and I were young and adventurous and thought it would be great. And in due course, we moved there.
So a young couple moving to this very remote place.
Yeah.
And I imagine it was actually quite controversial as well, because it was one of the largest cattle stations on the Cape and had been acquired for conservation. So how did that go down?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, there was a lot of flack about it at the time. And it was an interesting acquisition. Barry and I, we'd dealt with a bit of controversy there, and we were Switzerland really, and everyone, you know, we just got on with everybody and made it work. But yeah, it was certainly an interesting and character building exercise, moving there.
So people today, their view of a lot of national parks, that you go in, there's lots of facilities, there's toilets, there's, you know, pretty decent roads, and even actually Renewry Lakefield today has got quite a nice road in through there, and there's camping, designated camping spots. None of that would have been there when you moved in. So what was it like? Was there a road?
Yeah, and it was incredibly remote in those days. So this is the late 70s we're talking about. The bitumen used to end at Mount Carbine, And, you know, it was a fair trek just getting to Palmer River and, you know, yeah, going to Lakefield was a bit of a trek. When we first went there, there was still some of the property managers were still living there, still mustering cattle off the place. Our job originally was just sort of to get to know the place, get to know what was there, learn to get on with people. Yeah, we had some great times. But, yeah, the facilities were really basic. And, you know, we had a party line phone. So, you know, you would just ring it with the Morse code of your... Because you're on a party line with a whole lot of other people. And we were 4D, I think, when we first went to New Laura. So you only picked it up when you had the little D Morse code ring on your phone line. And, you know, we learnt to live with generators and... all sorts of, yeah, the Flying Doctor radio, you know, there wasn't the facilities or the internet or, you know, anything that there is these days.
And what was your human contact like then? Were there many people around?
No. You know, there was the odd, you know, the station people. So there would have been, you know, a couple of those. And, you know, Laura was then your closest.
Town.
Yeah, so... You know, it was probably an hour either way before there was any other people.
And was it open for business kind of straight away with visitors coming through?
No, definitely not. It wasn't gazetted as a national park until probably a year after we were there, I imagine. Mm. I can't remember exactly. But, so it was basically our job was to get to know the place and get to know what was there. And different people from national parks were coming up, of course, and... You know, trying to figure out what was there as well and how we were going to manage the place. And we were doing a lot of fauna survey stuff and, you know, spotlighting and, yeah, just acquiring information at that stage.
Yeah. You did at some stage while you were there have some rather interesting visitors come through.
This was just before the wet. And the wet season completely closes, you know, all those areas. The rivers flood just amazingly. That whole Princess Charlotte Bay area is incredible. And we had three blokes who came in a trayback Toyota just before the wet. And we'd been getting, you know, rain. The wet had really started. And they wanted to go through the back road, through Musgrave there, because the road was closed on the main road at the Kennedy River and they were trying to get back up to a property up near Lockhart. Yeah, they were pretty dodgy looking blokes. And one had a missing leg and one had a missing arm and... They were interesting to say the least, and we said, "Look, you won't get through. The saltwater creek will be flooded. You won't be able to get through." And they go, "Well, we're going." So they disappeared down the road, and a day or so later, Barry and Richie, who was the other ranger working with us at the time, were out fixing a phone line or doing something, and two of those blokes walked back in, and I was there by myself, and they told me that they drowned the car and. In the river and the fellow with only one leg was sitting on a fence post there as the waters were rising and we had about 11 inches of rain in 24 hours and so he stuck out there, which is probably an hour or more's drive from the property if you can drive it, but we couldn't. So these two fellows had to stay with us and you know, the whole time they were there they were offering us drugs and dodgy things like that and was all a bit wild and I had to get them some of Barry's clothes because they're all wet and I'm trying to keep them outside the house because I'm there by myself.
And so you were there by yourself?
I was very, very young.
You were on your own?
Yes. Yeah, we eventually had to charter a helicopter to go and get this fella off the fence post with one leg because he couldn't walk back in. Yeah, we had trouble getting a plane in to get them out and they never paid for the helicopter and it was all very odd. And then days later they chartered a plane to come in and get them out and fortunately the airstrip at Lakefield was pretty good and they got out. And then after the wet, many, many, many months later, a car drives in one day with another odd-looking fella who said that the car had belonged to him and these other fellas had taken it and he was going to try and retrieve it. And eventually they did get the car out, but it had gone completely underwater during the wet season and it was obviously a tow job to get it out. But we eventually found out that one of the fellas who'd stayed with us murdered that bloke who'd gone to get his car.
Oh, my God.
And burnt the house down, and he ended up in jail. And the other fella, the missing limb fellas, they beat up some old man and his dog in a rest area, and they were in jail as well. And it was all a little bit dicey at the time.
And you'd been there alone with yes. these fellas for a couple of days.
Well, not a couple of days, oh, but cool. it was the day yeah. till Barry and Richie had come back, yeah, and yeah. I was playing my cards very carefully.
I guess that's one of the challenges of living remotely, isn't it, when you are often on your own.
Absolutely, and there's no one within cooey of you. You know, if you need help, you've got to learn to be clever.
Yeah, yeah. And how you would have been, what, 19? 18. 20,
yeah, 18.
18 mm. at the time. Wow.
Yeah, 18 or 19.
Yeah, yeah so yeah, that, wow.
Oh, you learn all sorts of skills that you use for the rest of your life.
Shelley Lyon, ranger at the Steve Irwin Wildlife Reserve, Wenlock River, Cape York Peninsula.
My Cape York Life. Great stories from all around Cape York Peninsula. Search Cape York Land Manager on your browser or go to your favourite podcast app and search for My Cape York Life.
We're with Shelley Lyon by the Wenlock River. Her 40 years on the Cape began further south at Lakefield National Park, now known as Rinuru. But life was about to change. A baby is on the way, and a bloke called Steve Irwin was about to meet the Lyon family.
We were there for 3 years, and by this stage I was pregnant with our first baby.
Okay.
And being as isolated as it is, it's you've got to leave home and go somewhere for a month before, and we weren't sort of too keen on that. So we looked at some alternatives, and, Barry ended up getting a transfer to Mount Isa mm-hmm. in their compliance area of national parks, policing the kangaroo industry and bird industry. And so we moved out to Mount Isa where Josh was born. Mount Isa was an incredibly expensive place to live. Yeah. Everything was structured around mine wages, which national park wages aren't even close to. We were there for about 18 months and then and did a lot of camping out there. We had a wonderful time. Yeah, ended up transferring to Paluma, right up in the mountains north of Townsville there.
Mm, beautiful.
Yeah, in the rainforest. So that was desert to rainforest. It was
pretty amazing.
It was.
And so you're in Paluma for a little while as well.
Yeah, we were there for about another 18 months, I think. Okay. Had another baby. Sarah was born while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
National Parks were building a house at the bottom of the range at Jarama Falls and asked us would we like to move down there, which we did. Having two little kids that got car sick on that range all the time was a good incentive to move down to the bottom of the range.
Yeah.
And that's where Hannah was born, our third child.
So. Okay, and so there's your three young people in your life now.
Mm-hmm.
And Jarama Falls is a pretty beautiful place as well.
Oh, it's magnificent. Yeah. Waterfall creek that comes off the Sea View Range there. And, it's a very popular swimming hole. And
And so was you, yourself and Barry, you would have been doing visitor management there as well?
Yeah.
Or what was the role there?
Yeah. Well, I was busy being a mother and Barry was busy being a ranger. But
three young children.
Yes.
I imagine that was keeping you quite busy.
Indeed it was.
It was around that time that you met Steve Irwin.
Yeah, we did. So at the time the government had a crocodile management program going on the east coast of Australia where if you had an interest in acquiring crocodiles for some reason, Steve and his father Bob did, because they had a facility where they were showing them. You were allocated a certain section of the east coast, and you're allowed to catch and keep any crocodile over 1.5 metres. And so when they caught a crocodile, they needed to contact the local ranger who would process it before it was moved to their facility, and it was sexed and marked and length recorded and information like that. And Steve rocked up one day because Barry was the closest ranger to where he was working there near Kettle Creek, and in due course we became great friends and worked together for the whole time, yeah, that we knew him. Occasionally Steve would come and ask for some help if he had something he couldn't cope with, but he coped with everything, really. It was just amazing. You know, he did all this stuff on his own. It was absolutely amazing. But once the animal had been caught, it was just for National Parks records that all the details were taken before he could move it back down to the zoo. So, yeah, and he was camped there, you know, by himself for long periods of time. And so we were living quite close there in those days, and he'd often come in and spend time with us, and it was great. We became great friends.
And start of a lifelong friendship with the family.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm just going to pause for a minute, Shelley, because I'm just taking in, as the sun's coming up, peeking up over the over the river, and we've got beautiful trees reflecting into the river, and we can hear the water bubbling off in the background there, and the bird life is quite amazing here. What was that flew over?
Oh, there was a white-breasted sea eagle just downstream that was looking for some breakfast, and there's a Wampu pigeon calling across here. It's just absolutely paradise.
It's gorgeous. You did some safari tours as well. So what year are we at the moment?
Okay, so it's about 1989, very late 80s, where Barry just decided he'd would like a change from National Parks for a little while, and so we moved to a friend's farmhouse not far from Jarama Falls. Wildlife safaris for a few years.
That would have been pretty tough, I imagine, because it sounds very glamorous, taking people out bush and showing them the country, and I think it's something which people go, oh gee, I'd love to do that.
Exactly, it sounds like that, but it was hard work, and we thought about it a lot before we went into it, and we didn't want to go into debt buying a bigger vehicle, so we were using the Land Rover that we had. We didn't want to go in a partnership with people. We had quite a lot of people who wanted to, so there was a few good decisions that we made. So for a few years it was very hard work, because I was at home with three small children and Barry was away with up to four people he would take up the Cape and in the wet tropics, and it was hard work for him because he'd drive all day, stop, set up camp for everybody, cook food, and go again the next day. And then he'd come back, and then you'd have a short turnaround where all the swags had to be stripped and washed and reprovisioned, and I'd cook what I could for him to take. But so it was hard work for a while, but very interesting, and met a lot of people. And we never did a lot of advertising or anything. We sort of had one travel agent in the States that just used to fill us all the time. So it was great.
And that was enough, and you were yearning for the remoteness of Cape York once again.
Yeah, it gets in your blood. It's the safari business is hard because it's seasonal, of course. So, during the wet, you've got no income. And during that time, we did do some interpretive stuff for National Parks. So we'd go to, Wallaman Falls during Easter, and we'd do slideshows and guided walks and children's activities so we sort of got by, but we were certainly keen to get back up to Cape York, and were offered to go to Jardine River National Park at Heathlands.
That sounds beautiful. is beautiful.
And it is, yeah.
So it's quite a different area of Cape York, isn't it? It is actually quite diverse. It has quite a few different landscapes.
Yeah, very different, Lyndall. Very different to Lakefield, and we're very fortunate to go there. So we moved up just before the wet season, at the end of 93, Christmas 93. Got in just before the rains started. Yeah, it was interesting because in those days, there was no bridge over the Wenlock, and the road really did cut us off for about 4 to 5 months. Mm. So, just the logistics of providing for a family of five for 5 months is fairly interesting.
Yeah, so how do you do that? What do you have to prepare?
You just buy a lot of stuff and you make do, and it's hard because, you're going to have Christmas and all the kids' birthdays while you're there, and you've got to kind of think of all that in advance. And,
So yeah. did you ever have any surprises at Christmas time?
Oh, yes, we did. Sarah, our middle daughter, was desperate for some roller skates. And, you know, so we'd bought these things and, you know, Christmas comes and she opens them up and there's two left feet in the box.
Oh, no.
And it was when they were shoes, you know, so there was no getting by. But she did actually skate with two left feet because, I mean, you know, we're near the shops and you're not going to be for another 6 months. And, yeah, there's all sorts of funny things like that that happen when you're in Whoop Whoop.
Yeah, for sure.
We're with Shelley Lyon at the Steve Irwin Wildlife Reserve, having a chat by the Wenlock River. Shelley is a great storyteller, and she's had some adventures in her 40 years on the Cape. Beachcombing, finding a castaway, raising kids out in the bush, and the time husband Barry fell into a crocodile-filled river while working at Heathlands Ranger Station, 900 kilometres north of Cairns.
Heath grows on soil types that are quite nutrient deficient, so it's not very high, and there's not a lot of species diversity within it. Completely different landscape, but it's beautiful. But there was big sections of heathlands that were cleared in the 70s by Comalco when they were trying to establish it as a cattle property to provide beef for Weipa. Mm. So vast tracts of it were actually cleared and huge amounts of fertiliser were poured in and brachiera, you know, an improved pasture was planted. So some of it's not regenerating very well because fire gets through and it, you know, destroys a lot of the regrowth. But, you know, there's a lot of natural heath as well. And we're very lucky in that it's in quite a narrow part of Cape York. So and because it's sandy, it doesn't flood like Lakefield. So during the wet seasons, even though you cut off from the south and the north, you can still often get down to the east coast. So we would keep a boat down there and go down and enjoy the remote coast there, which was fabulous. And, you know, we'd get out to the islands in the boats and do a bit of fishing and beachcombing, which is my great love.
Yeah. So find any interesting things in the time when you were beachcombing?
Oh, over there, yeah, really. Yeah. There's always interesting things. And, you know, it's one of those remote areas where you can still go and find glass buoys, you know, that haven't been made for 40 years. But, you know, if you look in the right spots occasionally, you'll find the holy grail of beachcombing, a glass buoy. Yeah. But, and just funny things. You know, we found a carved giraffe one time, you know, like, probably 4 foot tall, and you just go, gee, I wish you could talk. Where'd you come from, you know?
Yeah.
Find that washed up on the beach. And, yeah, surfboards. Sometimes they surf the outer reef, you know, up there. And sometimes cross-sections of the bank, you know, eroding away, there'd be, like, middens and things. And, you'd find amazing stuff. And there's incredible sandstone formations along that northern coastline there. It's just magnificent.
It's very spectacular, isn't it? It's, I mean, even just driving in through the heath to the heathlands, all of a sudden you're going through, you've gone from eucalyptus forest, and then you come out into these hills of rolling heath, and it's just quite stunning.
Absolutely.
And then you drive down into this little pocket of rainforest.
Rainforest on sand, yes.
Yeah, which is quite unusual.
Absolutely.
And then you get through to that east coast where there's amazing sandstone cliffs and
caves with bats and it's stunning.
Fresh water seeping out of the walls.
Yeah, absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and not a person to be seen.
No, it was beautiful.
Mm. And you've said to me it's probably one of the favourite places you've lived?
Yeah, we really loved it there. It was interesting for our children because we moved from just south of Ingham there where we're living in a fairly affluent sort of cane-growing area where the kids went to a little two-teacher school where, you know, a lot of the cane farmers' kids went, that, and they had a lot of stuff. They were very well off and, you know, we weren't so at the time. And the kids, then we moved to Heathlands and probably our closest neighbours were half a day's drive away, and it was a family living, family called the Spencers that lived in a very, very remote area on the Harmer River down towards Shelburne Bay. and they would come in once a month to the mail plane to pick up mail. They were sort of, you know, who our kids then had most to do with, and their kids were older, but they had nothing. You know, the only toys they had were things that they made themselves, out, you know, from the bush. And it was just, yeah, fantastic life lesson that, you know, you don't need all this stuff to, you know, have a good time. And, yeah, it was really, that was really interesting. You got to admire people that can live off the land pretty much.
They were sort of your social contact a bit while you're up there?
Well, you know, they lived...
One of the families that you used to visit?
They lived so far away that we didn't go very often, but a couple of times we would go down to their place, and it was a really rugged track, and, you know, it's a long way to go. And one particular trip we went down, they took us down to the coast, down the river from where they lived in the boats, and we were going down for a picnic. And while we were there, they would catch a few fish with their homemade lures. They would carve wooden lures, and then they'd put the foil from the powdered milk tins on them because they had no paint or anything, you know, to attract fish. Then they would cut the fish up and just dry smoke them over a little fire while they were there and collect the fish to take home to eat later on. And, yeah, that was really interesting, and interesting for our kids to see that, you know, that as well. But while we were there this particular day, we were having having lunch down and smoking some fish and eating a bunch of bananas that they'd taken down and sitting there and just enjoying being on the coast and looked out, and there was a person walking along way out. The tide, you know, goes a long way out there, and we could see this person walking along, and we're looking at each other thinking, who's not here? You know, it was a really, really remote spot.
Yeah.
Anyway, we figured out that it was this bloke just walking out there, and so you presume that there's some problem, he's lost or...
So Shelley, we're... The place that we're talking about, just to give people a picture of where it is, so we're how many kilometres from the tip of Cape York and how far north of Cairns, perhaps? A couple of hundred?
I couldn't even hazard a guess. It's one of the most remote places I've ever been to
it's
in my life.
It's a long way. It's not
There's no settlements at all anywhere between Bamaga and Cooktown.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. Along the coast.
No, that's right. And we're a long way north.
Yeah.
We're a long way north. Yep. So Barry and Roger, the other fellow who was with us, went out, and as they got a little bit closer to this bloke, he started running away. And anyway, they eventually caught up with him, and he was an American. His name was Friendly, and he walked from Wattle Hills near the Pasco and just started walking up the coast.
That's crazy.
Not sure where he was going or what he was doing, but there was, you know, a bit of fresh water seeping out, and he'd been living on coconuts, and he was very happy to have some bananas and other food that we offered him. Yeah, he was a computer programmer or something from America, and he decided he didn't want to have any impact on society, and he just headed off.
As you do.
Pretty amazing.
And what happened to him? Where did he...
He eventually went back to Roger and Eva's for the night and had a good feed, and then they took him back down, and he kept walking, and we eventually heard he turned up in Bamaga, and he was, I don't know what happened from there.
Wow.
But you see some funny things, and when we were at Lakefield a couple of times, you know, you get people that were dropped off trawlers in Princess Charlotte Bay, and then they just start walking, and you just find them in the middle of nowhere walking along in their underpants or something. You do see some funny things in the bush.
It's amazing. Unreal. Was there a cyclone?
1994, yeah.
Somewhere at that time?
Oh, yeah, we had...
There's a story you've told me where...
Yeah.
Another one of these Home Alone stories for you, I guess.
Yeah, there's been lots of them over the years. But we'd actually gone fishing on the Dulhunty, just for a feed of fish. There was a bit of weather coming in. Barry was fishing... just on a tree, you know, overhanging tree, and it was a little bit wet, and I was sitting in the car because it was, you know, drizzling rain, and Josh was fishing, and I saw Barry slip off the log. I was waiting to see him get out of the river because he fell in the river, and he didn't get out, and I thought, what's going on here? And I walked over, and he's in the river, and I said, why aren't you getting out? There is crocs in here. And he said, I can't. Anyway, he, on the way down, falling down, he dislocated his elbow. So his elbow was very disfigured, terrible looking. And so I had to reef him out of the river, and he was in a world of pain, and get the kids in the car, and we had to try and get back to the ranger base at Heathlands, and we were about 2 hours away, and it was starting to rain quite heavily. So, you know, I was trying not to get bogged on the way, and Josh is in the back of the ute in the pouring rain, and the girls and Barry are in the car, and he's in a world of trouble. And he started losing feeling in his fingers, and I went, no, oh, this is not good. And I was trying, we had a flying doctor, VHF radio in the car, and I was trying to get the flying doctor, and I couldn't. And so I just had to drive, had to make sure that we all got back in one piece, and that was a long, long, long 2 hours. So when we got back, I got onto the flying doctor, and there was, you know, real severe weather coming in by that point. The flying doctor couldn't fly between Cairns and Heathlands because there was a cyclone coming in right between us, Cyclone Nina, and of course they're not going to fly in a cyclone. So I had to give Barry some pretty heavy-duty pain relief from the flying doctor kit. We just kept in touch with them, and sort of 24 hours later, the weather hadn't improved and Barry hadn't improved, and with a dislocation, you know, you don't want it being out that long. And they eventually made a decision to charter a helicopter from Horn Island to come and pick him up.
Oh, wow.
So from the north.
That's to the north.
Yes. So in due course, a helicopter came and picked him up and took him away. And so the children and I were at home now, and the cyclone was bearing in on us. So we had to weather the cyclone ourselves. Mm. Barry was in hospital on TI. And so they, you know, put him under general anaesthetic to fix his arm. And anyway, a day or so later, he was discharged. And so we've got wild weather, and he's half a day's, well, more than half a day's drive to the north across the Jardine River and Torres Strait, and had to try and get home.
And in the meantime, you've sat through the cyclone with the kids and done all the preparations that you have to do, because it's not cyclones in you know, they're a pretty big deal.
It was bearing down on us. Yeah,
it was coming straight for where you were.
Yes.
So you've got the responsibility of the ranger base.
Yes.
As well. So
yes.
It's looking after your children, getting everything ready. So pulling things inside and securing loose objects. And
everything, yeah.
Yep. Yep. So you've just done all that. So you've, in the middle of all of this, you've got your husband on a...
In hospital,
on
yes.
On a helicopter off to TI, and he's gone off and had some surgery. Mm-hmm. Or had some...
manipulation, yes. The next drama was trying to get him back. So he came across on the ferry from TI to Bamaga, walked to the police station and talked them into trying to drive him back down here as far as he could. The problem in the wet season on this far northern Cape York area is it's sand. So during the wet season, and we'd had a ton of rain, lots of these wattles just fall over the road all the time. So you really can't go anywhere without your chainsaw. And also the ferry that crosses the Jardine stops running because there's no tourists. There's no one anywhere. So they had to try and find someone in Bamaga to come down to the ferry, which is about an hour from Bamaga, to drive them across. And so the policeman, you know, he's got his chainsaw. He's got Barry, who's got one gammy arm and not much else with him because he'd sort of flown off with nothing. Anyway, they start on their way down. The fella comes to the ferry. This all sounds easy, but it was an incredible logistical nightmare.
It would be almost an hour now.
Oh, yeah.
From the ferry to
Bamaga. Yeah, in those days it was more.
And it would have been a lot longer then. So, and we're talking about dirt roads.
Yep.
That are sand roads.
Yeah.
There's been a cyclone. There's rain.
There's trees all over the road.
Yep.
So they start cutting their way. So the policeman's trying to drive Barry as far as he could. And I left Heathlands with the kids to drive north as far as I could. So the idea was that we'd meet.
And there's also no mobile phone reception here even now.
Nothing.
So back then, at least now we have satellite phones and things like that.
But yeah,
then,
no, we had no communication, except that we were both heading off. So the kids and I didn't get far at all. We probably got half an hour from home, and there was a massive tree, like way too big for me to deal with anything that I had. And we sat there for probably 5 hours, and you know, I just thought, I can't do anything. I could, and it was in the rainforest. I couldn't get around anything. There was absolutely nothing I could do. So by this stage, I had
three children. By now,
so
at this stage?
Josh was year six.
Okay.
Sarah was year four, and Hannah was preschool.
Okay. So still three little kids.
Oh, yeah. And they were hungry by this stage. You know, we didn't have a ton of stuff with us because we'd been remembering, you know, we'd been there for 5 hours just waiting now. So anyway, I left a note because I thought anything could have happened therein too. So I left a note and an axe. I don't know what Barry was going to do with an axe with one arm and this massive big tree. But I left a note saying that I'd be back at, you know, a certain time. I took the kids back home, you know, reprovisioned, you know, sorted out stuff, and then we eventually went back. Anyway, the other end, the fella at the ferry said, I'm only going to wait here till 5 o'clock or whatever it was. So the policeman and Barry had gone as far as they could, cutting off, you know, trees, keeping on coming as far as they could, and they eventually ran out of chainsaw fuel. So they couldn't do anything more anyway, and the policeman had to be back in time to get back across the ferry to Bamaga, because he would have been stuck in the middle of nowhere. And so Barry just talked the policeman into just leaving him there, and he just kept walking for hours and hours and hours. And he had, you know, no water. He was drinking out of puddles. Luckily it was wet, and he kept walking and walking and walking. And I don't know how long. He walked for many, many hours. And then eventually I came back with the kids, and he turned up at the big log, and he got home.
That's unreal.
With a gammy arm for a long time.
So that was a pretty big fishing trip.
Oh, yeah. Everything's exaggerated when you're in isolated areas. So everything sort of becomes a drama, and just because of distance, and nothing's easy. And it certainly teaches you to cope with all sorts of situations.
Yeah, it becomes part of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep,
and what an amazing service the Flying Doctor is, you know, and there's been many other times, you know, living on isolated properties where we've had to use the Flying Doctor for people, you know, all sorts of reasons, car accidents, motorbike accidents, you know, burns, all sorts of things. And yeah, they just do a mighty job. And we're still using them.
Shelley Lyon at the Steve Irwin Wildlife Reserve on northwest Cape York Peninsula. And we'll hear more from Shelley in the next episode of My Cape York Life. I'm Lyndall Scoble, and I hope you've enjoyed this first episode of My Cape York Life, a podcast featuring stories of the people who live, work on, and care for Cape York Peninsula. Tell your friends where to find us. We're on the web, your favourite podcast app, or you can find me by Googling Cape York NRM.